Hello everyone, and welcome to Shedding of the Ego. Today we are going to once again venture into the darker aspects of hybristophilia and female and male sexual attraction. We're going to be talking about Ted Bundy and the marriage proposal that he offered a woman in the middle of a court proceeding. We're going to be talking about lots of stuff, gentlemen. Hopefully you guys will enjoy, and thanks again for tuning in to Shedding of the Ego podcast. I wish to explore the topic of hybristophilia more deeply than my previous effort, which was part one, titled Hybristophilia, the Female Attraction to Violence. Now, in my previous submission, I hypothesized that hybristophilia, a sexual attraction to violence, can manifest in several ways, not simply in the case of the most extreme example of, you know, serial killer groupies that society tends to look at with shock and revulsion. I posited that female attraction lies instead on a hybristophilic spectrum, ranging from the average girl next door who likes her hair pulled a little bit during sex, all the way up to and including the women who not only fantasize about, but often go on to pursue romances with extremely violent men, which include the likes of Ted Bundy and Richard Ramirez, and more recently mass murderer Anders Behring Breivik. I came across a documentary that I'm going to include on the website post at sheddingoftheego.com for this submission. And it's a documentary that details, you know, some of these women who are in fact attracted to these men. And I'm not going to include any clips of that in this particular documentary. But again, if you want to watch the entire documentary, all the information is going to be included in the link bar. But the documentary is misleading. It follows the lives of several older or unattractive women that have developed affections for these high-profile killers and mass murderers, including Ramirez, who, again, terrified Los Angeles with a string of rapes and murders against women. The documentary gives the impression that only a desperate, lonely woman coming to terms with her faded sexual attractiveness could fall for such violent and dangerous men. Now, this is absolutely not the case, however. The Manson family is a perfect example of a violent man, Charles Manson in this case, securing the affection and devotion of multiple young and attractive women. Depicted here are Susan Atkins, Patricia Kernwinkel, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, and Leslie Van Houten. In the prime of their lives, you know, these girls are walking down this courtroom here, looking like, you know, fertile, perpetually youthful Woodstock flower children. And this is all after having committed, you know, the horrific murders that they did in service to this small, you know, little man, Charles Manson. Ted Bundy, after having been put on trial for not just murder, but brutal murder sprees in which at least 30 women died by his hands, had young, attractive groupies going as far as to dye their hair brown and wear it parted, so as to imitate the type of women that he killed. Now, there's a lot of speculation that the rejection of his first girlfriend, who wore her hair this way, long and parted in the middle, was what kind of triggered his killing spree. But I'm going to repeat that again. Young, attractive women dyed their hair to look like the woman that Ted Bundy targeted for murder. Now, the video that I'm about to play you details this, as well as the marriage proposal that was sent and accepted by Ted to one of his groupies, a woman by the name of Carol Boone, who is rumored to have been impregnated by Bundy in prison and likely gave birth to his daughter. And this marriage proposal all happened in the middle of a court proceeding. So we'll play that now.
From 1974 to 1978, a former Boy Scout with movie star looks and charm to match crisscrossed the country, a devious predator in search of prey. 30 young girls and women, ages 13 to 26, were raped and murdered before cops finally collared Ted Bundy. Reporters described Bundy's cold-blooded crimes in graphic detail, yet bags of fan mail arrived at his Florida jail during his trial.
Ted's mail was as strange as anybody's mail could be. He got marriage proposals, lots and lots of women sent him pictures, some sent him nude pictures to him, dying for Ted to get back to them.
In 1979, Bundy's trial became a public spectacle. Lovesick groupies showed up in court, desperate to attract attention.
There was an assumption about Ted's victims that they all wore their hair long, parted in the middle, and wore hoop earrings. So women would come to court with their hair parted in the middle, wearing hoop earrings. A couple of them even dyed their hair the right kind of brown, so they wanted to appeal to Ted.
These are very troubled women who are in a fantasy world. They've created a fantasy out of their relationship with this man or their imagined relationship with him.
Bundy married one of his admirers before a jury found him guilty and sentenced him to death. Vows are exchanged here at San Quentin an average of 10 times a year. Across the nation, the number of prison weddings totals more than 400 annually. Yet the most bizarre of all marriages involving a prisoner didn't happen behind bars. In 1980, 32-year-old Carol Ann Boone took the stand as a character witness during the trial of serial killer Ted Bundy. Bundy mocked the court and the entire judicial system by acting as his own attorney. He asked one very direct question of his number one fan.
Carol, do you want to marry me?
Yes.
And I want to marry you?
Yes.
And I do want to marry
you. He said you did.
He had taken advantage of ancient law in the books that talks about it, you know, that you can do this in a courtroom and then you're pronounced married. So he proposed to her, she accepted, giggling in the middle of, you know, them trying to decide if he's going to die.
He did. Ted Bundy was put to death in the electric chair in 1989 at age 42.
To this question of whether or not she really...
So, gentlemen, my opinion on all of this is that something deep down in the female psyche wants to be destroyed by a powerful man. And no, I don't necessarily mean literally. Perhaps a better word than destroyed would be absorbed. But this can range from, for example, the traditional housewife who wants a strong, dominant man to destroy her metaphorical soul so she can be alleviated of the burden of having to navigate reality, opting instead of having her independent mind intact to let her man do all the thinking and all the deciding, all the way up to women who literally want to have their real soul, their very lives, devoured by a charismatic psychopath. Women want to be consumed by men, as long as these men allow themselves to be consumed right back. The traditional wife's husband consumes himself when he dies 10 years before her on average. And Ted Bundy, well, you know, he got the electric chair, didn't he? A little known fact, and a fascinating read, frankly, comes in the form of a memoir titled The Phantom Prince, My Life with Ted Bundy, penned by Liz, I don't know if I'm pronouncing this correctly, Kloepfer, that's Kloepfer, which was Ted Bundy's fiance of 5 years, during which he was committing many of the murders that he would eventually be executed for. So I was spellbound by this book. I read all 180 pages of her account with this serial killer all in one night, fixating on certain parts from a MGTOW perspective. I might actually do a video on that book alone. But what I was trying to do was to pick out the parts where a seemingly, you know, intelligent and somewhat well-off woman gives way to the furious spinning of her hamster, making every excuse to push down her suspicions that Ted was in fact a serial killer, until the evidence became just too overwhelming to deny. And to her credit, she did eventually go to the cops and report Ted Bundy, or at least her suspicions. Finally, Ted admitted to the crimes to her himself, and even still, after knowing he viciously slaughtered so many women, after he admitted to Liz that he had even had thoughts about killing her and her daughter, she ends her account of the book as such. Quote, "In the middle of the night, phone call from Florida, Ted told me that he tried to stay away from me whenever he felt the power of his sickness building in him. I wondered if those times coincided with times I felt so left out, felt that he was hiding something from me. I suspected that it was other women, and it often was, but he was also hiding a terrible secret. He loved life and enjoyed it to the fullest. The tragedy is that this warm and loving man is driven to kill." This is her account, right, of a man who slaughtered women, hid their bodies so as to avoid capture and conviction, and came back to the bodies multiple times to practice necrophilic acts on these women. And it's almost as if her main concern with wrapping this book up is that she felt left out at certain points and times in their relationships. And she tries to, in a sense, apologize for Ted. Right? Listen to that line again. The tragedy is that this warm and loving man is driven to kill. I mean, it's just the depths to which women will rationalize men that they love and that they perceive to be charismatic and, for lack of a better word, alpha, is just staggering. And I'm not even saying that she's wrong, but it's just an observation. It's very potent and very powerful, and the amount of mental gymnastics that can take place to make excuses for bad men, and you know, in this case, Ted Bundy was by definition a bad person, you know, a murderer, a killer. It's just amazing to watch. Even the knowledge that he had her and her 12-year-old daughter in his murderous thoughts isn't enough to dispel the fog of war and euphoria that is a whirlwind romance with a man whom she perceives as an alpha male. Now, I don't usually like to dabble in PUA content and PUA definitions. You guys know my feelings on that. But I think in this isolated example, I feel that the concept of the alpha widow is apt, which is described by a Reddit post on the Red Pill Reddit. And of course, I'm going to have a link to all of that, but I'm just going to read to you what was written here. The idea of an alpha widow is something that pops up occasionally here on the Red Pill, and I think it deserves some attention and consideration. The concept is actually very central to why we criticize the cock carousel and why it's harmful for women's long-term mating strategy. So for the sake of this conversation, let's arrange SMV in percentile. 90th percentile is top 10. The typical Western girl in her 20s isn't looking to settle down, she's looking to have fun. Let's make a hypothetical girl, we'll call her Jane. Let's say Jane is a fairly okay but still very average girl. We'll put her at the 60th percentile at the age of 22. Jane likes to sleep with guys who are 80th plus percentile. These guys don't mind stooping downwards because guys love sex, and for him, she's just another plate to spin who didn't take much effort. Once, she even was a plate for a guy who was 95th percentile, a real top dog. She didn't even make this guy wear a condom. He's handsome, in shape, wealthy, has a nice apartment and an expensive car and a fat dick. He's sleeping with a lot of other girls at the same time. She doesn't care because girls would rather be one of the many in the harem of an alpha than the one and only of some disgusting, creepy beta. And again, you know, I don't use this kind of language. I don't like this kind of language, but for lack of a better word, I'm just quoting the text here. He fucks her a few weeks, then he moves on. This guy is now her high watermark for the kind of guy that she thinks she can get. But her fatal flaw is in assuming that she could ever get such a guy to commit to her. This kind of guy will fuck her, but that's it. Why would a 95th percentile guy commit to a girl like that? Not a chance in hell he would do that. But yeah, he'll dump her load in her every now and then, no question of that. Fast forward 10 years, and now she's 32, she's gotten fatter, started to get wrinkles, she's less fun and cheerful than she was in her 20s, and generally less attractive. Let's now say she dropped in value to a man. Now let's say she's 40th percentile. However, in her mind, she's increased in value. She now has a master's degree in women's studies and a 32K year job in HR and two cats. This is a woman on top of her game. She now decides it's time to settle down because that biological clock is ticking. But she finds that any of the type of men that she wants won't commit to her. She's used to banging 80 plus percentile guys. Remember the one who was 95 as well? And therefore imagines that this is the type that should marry and commit to her. But the reality is, now that she's looking at guys who are double her sexual marketplace value, men who are equal to her SMV, she sneers at because they're, quote, creepy and, quote, gross, and she could do better, and she knows it. She's just awesome, obviously. Every man, all her friends, her parents, media, music, and everyone else in society has been telling her since she was a toddler that she's awesome and great and perfect. Obviously, it must be true. And that's why she dated so many hot guys in her 20s, but nevertheless, nobody will commit to her. Why are men such jerks? Where have all the good men gone? The world has wronged her. She's a victim. She's owed something that she isn't getting, and it's men's fault because they're the ones not giving it to her. Now she's 35 and realizes she has almost no time left to have kids. She marries a guy who was equal to her sexual marketplace value, another 40th percentile. He's not a bad guy, and there's nothing specifically offensive about him, but he isn't in shape, handsome, interesting, smart, or wealthy. Never mind the fact that she herself is not in shape, handsome, interesting, smart, or wealthy either, but that doesn't stop her from secretly resenting his mediocrity. She silenced this resentment until the kids were pumped out, but in her mind, this guy isn't her equal. This guy is 40% lower in SMV than the men she used to fuck. This guy is a fucking loser. Till one day, he leaves the toilet seat up after he came home exhausted from working a 14-hour day to pay for their children, and she decides that she's had enough of his abusiveness and that she deserves better. Cue divorce and cash prizes. Now she's 40 and hanging out in bars buying Long Island iced teas with her kids' child support money, hitting on men twice her SMV, while the kids tuck themselves in on a Friday night and can never hope to see daddy again. Now relax, gentlemen, this vlog will never turn into some dick measuring contest where I shame men to not be quote beta or what have you. Again, a brief search of the PUA category on my website will make it clear how I feel about them, but they are occasionally accurate in their assessments of women. Women will endure any hardship for lust and the stern guidance of an assertive male. This is not right or wrong, but it simply is. It is our job as MGTOW, however, to educate each other about this potent evolutionary quirk so as to not fall victim to it. I assure you, you do not want to be on the business end of one of these, you know, alpha male brutes these women love when the time comes for him to occasionally prove to her that he, in fact, is the silver-backed gorilla she perceives him to be. I want you to watch another video of a former model for a company named Bus Boosters, of all things, Victoria Redstall, befriend and then actually have a romance with a serial killer named Wayne Adam Ford, who had a penchant for cutting off the breasts of the women he killed.
And you, my dear Wayne, you are our tour guide. I have a serial killer as a tour guide, Wayne.
I know you do, and I've already admitted that for you, okay? The fact is, a serial killer and a serial murderer might not be the same thing.
Well, which one are you?
Nice try.
Which one are you?
I already told you.
I forget.
I told you I'm a serial killer.
That's amazing to watch, isn't it? Right? How she playfully flirts with him on the phone, captivated by his voice like some love-struck schoolgirl, how she cries with him on the phone. This man murders women just like her and extricates their body parts. Such is the power of blind female attraction. Reason stands no chance. Redstall insists that her relationship with Ford is exclusively platonic, a deep friendship and nothing more, but in the book Body Parts that she wrote in, she is quoted as saying the following in regards to Wayne. She says, quote, "I will kiss your eyes, drink your tears if you have any, kiss every part of you that I can without getting into trouble, hold your hands, kiss your hand, your arm, your fingers, your lips. I love you like a drug that I cannot get enough of," end quote. Doesn't sound very platonic to me. Notice the desire to consume his very essence. This woman is willing to drink the man's salty bodily fluids just to feel closer to him. This is what I mean when I say this type of female attraction is one in which she wants to be overtaken, assimilated into the Borg of a man's masculinity, with the benefit, of course, of being able to wield that masculinity as a violent force when necessary. So to be clear, I don't wish this post to read simply as an indictment of the depravity of female sexuality. There are many, many men who seem to have the same sexual attraction to violence, some of which I will mention here. I only wish to make the claim that although human sexuality is extremely complex and there are men who are indeed hybristophiliacs, there are evolutionary forces within female sexuality that make them somewhat more likely to select for violent traits in men. Now, when women talk about their attraction to a man in uniform, right, or a cop, or a young, handsome Marine, they are in fact subconsciously voicing the same kind of compulsion that led the Manson girls, or Carla Homolka, or Liz Klopfer to their attraction to men, which by all accounts they should in fact deem repulsive. It is not a general love of violence for these women, but a love of the stability and safety that potentially having access to this violence offers to them. It will sound as though I'm giving male sexuality a pass in regards to some very similar situations, but the distinction must be made that many instances where men express sexual attraction to violent women is not born out of the violent actions that the female takes, but instead a simple reaction to a woman who is physically attractive and just so happens to be violent. I have seen hundreds and hundreds of comments about the infamous case of Casey Anthony, who was acquitted of murdering her daughter, but has been deemed guilty by public opinion to the same degree that O.J. Simpson is of his crimes, right? Talking about how hot this woman is, who almost surely is a child murderer. Almost all of these comments were from men. Now, to be fair, she can, I think, reasonably be said to be objectively attractive by any reasonable standard. But you would think that the thought of her killing a little girl, her daughter, mind you, would be enough to short-circuit the attraction these men may have for her, but apparently not. But it is, in my opinion, conclusively not the violence that attracts men to these kind of women in the majority, but just her physical features. If they met a woman who looked exactly like Casey Anthony, who hadn't committed these acts, they would be no more or less attracted to her. And if they met a woman who was not physically attractive to them, who did commit these acts, they wouldn't be attracted to her. The attraction is based on a purely physical assessment. And the same can likely be said about men who think that female sexual predators are sexually attractive. I've said this before in many, many videos, but the first thing you will hear when striking up a conversation with your average group of men about the latest pussy past 30-something who seduced some teenage boy is an almost unanimous proclamation of, you know, man, where were these teachers when I was in high school, am I right? Now, when men say this, they aren't thinking about the psychological and social and legal damage these women who are child molesters of the worst kind, the kind in position of authority and who possess the neoteny to get away with it, have done to these young boys just as they were transitioning into adulthood. They are simply reacting to a pretty face and that's that. Their thought process never gets to the point where the young boy turns 18 and is then forced to pay child support. It is, again, just pure physical attraction. The true male hybristophiliacs are the men that actually get off on women doing violent things. Now, there's the phenomena of crush porn. This is a sexual fetish that involves mostly men watching women in sharp stiletto heels crush innocent animals ranging from chicks to kittens to puppies. Now, on a rational level, I understand the need for our species to place primacy over life forms distinct from our own. I understand why we believe ourselves, with good reason, to be a more valuable form of life in comparison to a fly or a mosquito or an elephant or even other primates. We are the most sentient species we know of by any reasonable standard, and life that can think and derive physical equations that can explain the mechanisms of our universe are, it can be argued, objectively more valuable than life forms that cannot. But there is something that creeps down into the deepest fibers of my being and comes back up with the most potent hatred my brain can muster for people who kill dogs and other innocent animals. To me, you know, dogs are special creatures that should be protected and cared for. Anyone that would break the special bond we humans have cultivated with the canine species that has earned them the title of being man's best friend is a despicable human being, in my opinion, but nonetheless, human sexuality will pursue what it wants one way or another. I make the argument that men like this, who derive enjoyment from graphic acts of female animal abuse, are an example of true male hybristophiliacs. There are certainly women who likely watch these animal crush porn videos as well, but I would wager that most people who are consuming these porn videos are men with a deep need to fantasize about women in positions of authority and power. One notable case I found in an article titled "Videographer Gets 50 Years in Animal Crush Porn Videos" stated the following. A Houston man has been sentenced to 50 years in prison for cruelty to animals for his role in filming animal crush videos. Brent Justice, age 54, was convicted and sentenced Monday for cruelty to non-livestock animals. He and Ashley Richards, age 25, were arrested in August 2012 after a complaint from people for the ethical treatment of animals, otherwise known as PETA. Investigators said Justice filmed scantily clad Richards, sometimes masked, stabbing animals, including a puppy, a kitten, and a chicken, as well as chopping off their limbs and urinating on them while making sexual comments to the camera. Crush videos are a part of fetish culture in which small animals like puppies and kittens are tortured or killed for the sexual gratification of observers. Videos of the acts usually shown online have been marketed as rituals or sacrifices. Richards was convicted in 2014 on state charges and sentenced to 10 years in prison. Last year, she pleaded guilty in federal court to 4 counts of creating Animal Crush videos and 1 film distribution charge under the Animal Crush Video Prohibition Act of 2010. In one of these videos seized by authorities, Richards punctured a cat's eye with a shoe heel. I know, gentlemen, this is absolutely repulsive, but just bear with me. Richards punctured a cat's eye with a shoe heel. In other videos, she used a meat cleaver and other knives to maim animals. The videos were produced in Houston from about 2010 to 2012. End quote. So the man who filmed the crimes, right, received a 50-year sentence, while the woman actually doing the killing received a 10-year sentence, right? It's nothing like having that pussy pass for a 1/5 sentence time on such a despicable crime, but it is what it is. The most bizarre, and I dare say interesting example, I think, of male hybristophilia that I could come across came in the form of a mid-level East Oakland drug dealer named Charles Cosby and his fateful encounter and subsequent romance with a woman named Griselda Blanco, the self-professed baddest bitch to ever take a breath of life. And if you think her claim was in any way an exaggeration, you have not read up on this woman. She was an unadulterated, mass-murdering psychopath who also managed to work her way up from the streets of Colombia to being the foremost Colombian drug king or queenpin of her time. The woman mentored Pablo Escobar himself and was arguably just as ruthless, directly ordering hundreds, perhaps thousands of murders in hopes of exterminating her rivals in the Colombian drug trade, a goal she eventually succeeded in, becoming a multi-billionaire in the process. Now, Charles Cosby decided to randomly send Blanco a letter while she was in prison detailing to her his admiration for her business savvy and unwillingness to take shit off of, well, you know, anyone. And to his surprise, Griselda responded, a romance ensued, and an unknown California Eazy-E lookalike drug dealer became in one fell swoop the main love interest of the most powerful female criminal on the planet. A documentary called Cocaine Cowboys 2 was made, and gentlemen, it is one hell of a watch. The trailer is included in the description. I highly recommend it. Now, at first, I was under the impression that Cosby was with this woman who was much older than him, simply for the connections and business opportunities a romance with her would provide. The man became a millionaire shortly after meeting her, I believe in a matter of days, if I recall correctly. But there are sections in the documentary where he recalls their conjugal visits in prison, where he regales the viewer with stories about their sexual encounters, and he passionately described her as a regal queen and discusses how the first time he saw her, he was just blown away by how beautiful she was and how she was this vision of feminine royalty. The entire story unfolds like a real-life Dickensian saga, and after watching the first equally enrapturing installment, I highly recommend you give the second one a watch, gentlemen. Now, perhaps I'm reading too much into it, but the way he described their relationship, it seemed like equal parts business and pleasure. Perhaps you guys can watch and, you know, tell me if you disagree, but it certainly seemed that way as I watched. Now, assuming he truly had some kind of feelings for this woman, this was a man who was attracted to a woman that killed hundreds more souls than Ted Bundy or Richard Ramirez, and that's some food for thought, gentlemen.